Miguel Perez is an Army veteran with a green card and a drug conviction, and for that, he was deported to Mexico.
So I think he's in shock pretty much as far as mostly fear, like fear of what's going to happen, where am I going to live, you know, where am I going to stay at. It's a lot of anxiety.
That's Hector Barajas, himself a deported vet in Mexico. What's happening to the veterans and why? We'll delve into those questions. Also, CSAs, community-supported agriculture groups, were supposed to reinvent the farmer-buyer relationship. But
the CSA space has gotten really tight, and a lot of CSAs have gone under.
We'll find out how CSAs are evolving, and get ready for some cuteness.
Congratulations, Mrs. Garrett!
Carrie Garrett's first graders congratulating her on her prestigious award this month. We'll talk to Illinois' Golden Apple winners. That's all coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nova Safo in for Nyla Boodoo. Well, spring is here, though you'd be excused if the weather didn't tip you off. For some of you, this is the time of year that your participation in community-supported agriculture groups, CSAs, will begin to pay off. You might have deliveries of fruits and veggies on the way. But does your box of goods include Alaska salmon? No? Well, did you know it could? CSAs are evolving to survive in a very competitive environment. Farmer entrepreneurs are looking for a new edge. Joining us is Madeline Beck, reporter with Harvest Public Media and the Illinois Newsroom. She tracked down where you can get Alaska salmon delivered to your door. Also joining us is Nicholas Mink, the president of that very fishy CSA, Sitka Salmon Shares in Galesburg, Illinois. And we're also joined by Guillermo Payette, president of Local Harvest, which is a database for CSAs and farmers markets. Welcome to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. All of you may try to hold on to that enthusiasm. All right, Madeline, let's begin with you. I know you wrote a story about how CSAs are growing and changing because while there's a lot of appetite for seasonal organic food, the marketplace is really big. There's a lot of competition. We'll tweet out a link to your story, but tell us, what's going on? Is this a buyer's market?
Well, at the moment, it's a little bit of a flooded market. There's a lot of CSAs out there, and a lot of the kind of market that those sorts of consumers are part of, this middle class or upper middle class group, are kind of being divided, not only from CSAs, but also from meal kit companies like HelloFresh and Blue Apron. And so it's getting a bit competitive at the moment.
So we're talking about home deliveries of foods. How are CSAs different? What exactly are they? Because it's still a very niche market, and a lot of people may not have heard of it. What does it exactly do, and how does it work?
Yeah. No, it actually, it only started in about the mid-80s in the United States, and so it's not too old. But basically, the idea is that farms and farmers could sell their produce directly to their consumers. So you have this relationship. At the same time, the people who buy their produce, even if they might spend a little bit more, directly support their community and their own farmer. So that's the idea behind it. And it kind of grew at a substantial rate at the end of the 90s, early 2000s. Then through 2008 is when there was a big boom in that local food movement. But now things are kind of evening off, as Guillermo was the one who was pointing out that specific trend.
All right, and I'll take that bait. Guillermo Payette from Local Harvest, tell us, has the number really grown expansionally? Where are we with CSAs? And also, are they helping farmers?
CSAs started growing like in mid-80s. By 2000, there were maybe about 1,000 CSAs. And then it's gone up to maybe about 7,000. Nobody knows exactly how many CSAs there are. We probably have the most accurate number, which we know of, 7,500. But in the last 5 or 6 years, that number has stayed steady. As a lot of CSAs are having trouble growing. Some are still growing, but most of them are just kind of staying at the same size. The problem is that the competition from bigger businesses is becoming really strong. So meal kits, for example, right? The size of the meal kit market right now, it's about $5 billion. CSAs, if you say that the average CSA has about 100 subscribers and each subscriber spends about $500, the entire CSA space is only about $750 to $1 billion a year. Mm-hmm. And the meal kit companies, which aim at exactly the same cross-section of the public as a market, they are five times as big because they spend a lot of money on advertising and marketing.
So are you saying that there really isn't the demand right now to justify 7,500 different CSAs in the country?
There is a demand. The problem is that it's a battle out there between the originators of this idea, which are the small, medium farms that want to sell directly to the consumer and that way not have to pay big margins to the wholesalers, with companies that have come in to pretty much build businesses on the same space, right? Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of these companies are losing money like crazy. Blue Apron, I think, is losing like $30 million a quarter, and they lose 75% of their clients every 6 months. So my guess is that this cash burn that's happening on the milk companies eventually is going to peter down, and then what's going to happen is that the CSAs once again are going to continue growing at the organic rate that they used to.
Well, and we want to let our listeners know that if you belong to a CSA and you'd like to join our conversation, you can tweet us. At 21st Show is where to send your comments and questions. And we'd like to turn now to possible solutions where there's a problem. There's someone trying to think of a solution, and that someone is Nicholas Mink of Sitka Salmon Shares. Hello, Nick.
Hi. Hi, guys.
So what is it exactly that you're... what is it exactly that you're doing to kind of help figure out a new way of CSA surviving?
Well, we started... we're a collective of fishermen that small and medium-scale fishermen that direct market our fish through a modified CSA or a CSF, so a community-supported fishery. And we made our first deliveries from Sitka, Alaska into the Midwest 8 years ago, as Guillermo pointed out, well before this meal kit explosion happened. I think we were delivering fish before the Plateds and the HelloFreshes and we've been able to continue our growth and expand rapidly, but for us, we have definitely had to evolve. We have had to take a lot of the playbook from, I think, some of the larger meal kit companies. We're doing much more with recipes, making access to understanding how to use product much easier. And then for us, what we've done, as opposed to a lot of CSAs, is we've taken that last step directly to the consumer, and we home deliver the product. And so right now, in order for us to survive, we've had to do a lot to make the product more accessible, make it easier to use, and make it more convenient. And the CSAs that I've worked with and the CSAs that I've seen continue to grow, and that, I mean, one example is the Broad Branch Farms that's not too far from us in Galesburg, Spurgeon Veggies that's in Galesburg. They've had to do a lot of the same things. They've had to, start home delivery. They've had to make their shares more flexible for consumers. As the meal kit space gets more and more crowded and as more and more people expect high-quality local organic food to be more and more accessible, I think the 7,500 extant CSAs, or there are 200 extant CSFs, are going to really have to follow that trend and make sure we're keeping up with this evolving market. And then we have a very exclusive product. We have proprietary processes in place to bring very, very high quality fish directly from our collective Alaska fishermen to our consumer members in primarily in Illinois, Wisconsin, Indiana, Iowa, and Minneapolis.
If I was to join your, buy a share in Sitka Salmon Shares, what would that cost me?
We generally we try to be able to provide fish at about the cost of a Whole Foods or a nicer fish market. So it's anywhere between $15 to $25 a pound, depending on the species mix that you're interested in, and that includes recipes, that includes newsletters, where your fish was caught, how it was caught, mm-hmm. and includes a lot of access to different member events and sales. And so
it seems like
we try to.
Yeah, it seems like one of the ways you guys are trying to evolve is go from just selling a product to selling an experience. Would that be fair to say?
Well, I think the community, it is as much of an experience as it is a product, but I think that's core to the community supported business model, right? We believe very strongly in the way in which communities can change our food system, and that's both communities of producers and communities of consumers that are working together to help, in our case, build a better seafood system. And so, of course, that has a very experiential component. If people just wanted to go to a grocery store and buy $10 a pound farm salmon that they don't know where it comes from and that's not a part of a community and it's frankly cheaper, that's a choice that a consumer makes. But on our end, as a community-building institution and as a community-based institution, the experience is just as important as that piece of fish in our home deliveries.
Yeah, Madeline, I wanted to turn to you. In the reporting that you've been doing, what have you been hearing from consumers as to what the kind of problems they've had with CSAs or friction that is preventing them from joining in the first place? Because there does seem to be quite an evolution in what Nick is describing about what he's doing and what other CSAs he's working with are doing. Is that in response to specific consumer complaints or reasons people have left CSAs or not joined?
I don't know about complaints as much as just changing tastes and changing requirements. I mean, if you have the option now of having something so extremely accessible like Blue Apron and like HelloFresh, people can choose that accessibility. But if your CSA doesn't, you know, you have to weigh those options. And at the same time, people will start CSAs, get super excited about it. I've talked to a couple people who, you know, started up, did it, and then they just kind of, well, maybe I'm going to do this. They almost got bored or distracted because they had stuff going on at home. They don't have time to go pick up a box, things like that. They want the accessibility of something coming directly to them. I've even talked to people who have switched to just Blue Apron. They use it every week. There are people who do that just because they can get it directly shipped to them. So, I mean, like I said, it's not so much complaints as it is just people deciding that they now have the option of having something that they believe is more fresh or better for them coming directly to their doorstep.
And besides salmon, what are some other different examples that folks in Illinois might have access to with these evolving CSAs?
Well, there's a couple around Illinois. You can probably find there's a few out there that are pie CSAs. Over in Iowa, I found some flour CSAs. California, I think, has the strangest CSAs that I've found. I've found pickle CSAs there. I've found, and you can find fresh bread CSAs throughout most of the United States now, people just selling home-baked bread.
You have to really like pickles, I think, for the pickled CSA.
Yeah, it's just every kind of pickled thing, not even just regular pickles, like pickled cauliflower, pickled beets, you name it. They sell you a box of random pickled vegetables or seasonal pickled vegetables.
It both sounds delicious and redundant after a while. But Guillermo, you're in California. What trends are you seeing across the country when it comes to CSAs? Are people still really excited about farm fresh food? Companies like Blue Apron and HelloFresh, they've been struggling. So what does that mean for CSAs and the broader trends?
People are really excited about locally grown and farm fresh food. The one thing that's happening is a lot of these companies, they get some of their produce local sustainable grown, but most of it is wholesale. And the consumer doesn't really know that because they don't read the fine print. But what we're seeing in the CSA space in general, because we work with about 200 farms that we work closely with because they use our software to run their operations, is that there are two main kinds of farms that are doing well, that are kind of bucking the trend, that are actually growing. One is the kind that is really trying to compete directly with the meal kits by offering convenience, right? The convenience is king thing, where they do custom boxes and home deliveries and all the things that the meal kit companies offer, they do, except for actual meal kits, because we found out that the labor involved in building the kits is just too high for a small farm to do in a way that is reasonable. But then the other kind of CSAs that are doing well are the ones that really keep the focus on the community, which was pretty much the original idea of CSA, right? The original idea is you are part of the farm. You buy a share into the farm, like a shareholder. So the farms that are really making a point of staying in touch with their customers, inviting them for events at the farm, inviting them to visit, sending newsletters, we feel that those are actually doing okay. They're bucking the trend of the meal kits taking away the space.
All right. Well, you've all given us a lot to chew on, if I may say. Thank you all very much. Madeline Beck of Harvest Public Media and the Illinois Newsroom, Nicholas Mink of Sitka Salmon Shares in Galesburg, Illinois, and Guillermo Payette joining us from California. He heads the Local Harvest, a database for CSAs and farmers markets. Thank you all so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nova Safo, in for Nyla Boodoo. We're going to turn our attention now to American military veterans who are deported to foreign countries. Their stories came into the spotlight because of Miguel Perez, a Special Forces veteran from Chicago who fought for a year and a half to stay in the country. Perez served two tours of duty in Afghanistan, was diagnosed with PTSD after leaving the military, and was convicted of a drug crime. He served time in jail and then was detained for deportation. His fight ended over the weekend. Miguel Perez is now in Mexico, where there are dozens of other American military veterans, also deported. Their leader of sorts is Hector Barajas, himself a deported veteran, who runs a support organization for others like him. I should clarify that these are legal immigrant veterans we're talking about who committed a crime after they left the military and before they went through the citizenship process. That's the law. Any green card holder can be deported for committing a serious crime. But the veterans say their military service and the mental and physical injuries many suffered in combat should be taken into account. Hector Barajas spoke with me earlier by telephone, and we began with how Miguel Perez is now doing.
Well, he just barely got deported, so I think he's in shock pretty much as far as mostly fear, like fear of what's going to happen, where am I going to live, you know, where am I going to stay at. And, you know, that's a lot of anxiety. He was able to meet his family last night, so that was very important to have his family around and that support system.
Now, I understand you yourself are also a deported veteran. Is that right?
Well, that's correct. I was deported back in 2004, and recently I got a pardon from the governor. I'm actually supposed to get a decision tomorrow about my citizenship, so hopefully I'll become an American citizen.
Well, congratulations on the pardon, sir. And what state were you living in, and what was the cause of your deportation?
Sure. So I grew up in Compton, California, and the reason I was deported, I was involved in a shooting, a discharge of a firearm, and that's what led to my deportation.
And what was your service in the military?
I served in the U.S. Army from 1995 to 2001. I got an honorable discharge, and I served with the 82nd Airborne.
Do you think Miguel Perez's case is unique? Is it pretty similar to other cases of deported veterans? How would you describe it?
Well, you know, everybody has different cases. You know, he's just one of hundreds, really. You know, if there's not one person that has a particular crime, or that there's no real pattern. This is basically different people committing different crimes, but they all served in the armed forces.
And his kind of state of mind right now in Mexico, arriving, just a couple of days ago, is it something you're familiar with, in seeing when soldiers come in for the first time?
Definitely. When I got deported, there was an anxiety of, like, again, fear of where am I going to be at, what's going to happen to my family, my children, how am I going to survive? I think everybody goes through that. And then after that, you start missing your family and your kids. But I think he's also he's got freedom. He's finally not in a detention center, and I think that helps out as well.
And how many soldiers or veterans of the military, in the American military, are there right now in Mexico that you are working with, that you are helping?
We have a database of around 350 people being deported to various countries around the world. Mostly are Mexican.
And what kind of help are they needing from you and your organization? What are you doing for them?
So we help with the housing. We help out with helping them connect with attorneys, criminal attorneys, immigration attorneys. We help them file for their VA benefits, helping them find work, and just connect with other people that are in similar situations and have a safe place to, go if they have any needs.
Now, I understand that a lot of these soldiers, they may have not lived in another country and certainly not in Mexico for many, many years. Some of them immigrated when they were just little children and may not even speak Spanish. What kind of culture shock is there for soldiers who are deported to Mexico because they're going to a country they may not have known for many, many years?
So there is a culture shock. You are, you're displaced to a country where you might have not lived there since you were like 2 years old. And, you have to find out how the currency works, where to use the medical, and, sometimes even the language. You might not even speak the language as well.
And how long does it take for your organization? How long does it take for these soldiers to get acclimated, to adjust?
Everybody's different. There's guys that are still struggling. they haven't accepted the fact that they're deported and they have a lot of mental health issues and a lot of emotional issues. And some guys, within a month, they got a job, they've got their own apartment, they got their IDs. It just depends on the person.
What are the chances that these vets can make it back to the U.S.? How often does it happen that they win their legal cases and are able to come back?
Since veterans have been deported over 20-something years, since 1996, I can count the veterans that have gone home. So it's a very, very small number. You have to get rid of your criminal record before you can work on getting home, and that's the biggest hurdle.
What do you want people in here in the United States to know about the fate of veterans currently overseas, the fate of the veterans that you're working with in Mexico? What do you want people to know?
I want people to know that we still have a commitment to our soldiers, that these people are still patriots, and that regardless of what they've done, we don't condone criminal activity, that they paid their debt to society, and we should bring home our deported veterans. They're still our veterans, and they shouldn't be deported.
Hector Barajas, director and founder of Deported Veterans Support House in Tijuana, Mexico. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Okay, thank you.
And I'm joined now by Christopher Bergen. He's the attorney for Miguel Perez. Mr. Bergen, welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. Is the legal fight now over for Mr. Perez?
No, far from it. We are pursuing an appeal of the denial in the Chicago District Office of his request for citizenship. And we can then, if they deny it at the administrative level, we can move up the, federal court ladder on that. So we're pursuing that. And we have quite a champion that we've had on Miguel's case in Senator Tammy Duckworth, herself obviously a pretty severely wounded war veteran who has been just, she introduced a private bill in the Senate on behalf of Miguel to make him a citizen, and it is, she's just working with the within the rules of the Senate, which are very have been made more difficult under the Trump administration, in order to pursue that private bill that would actually, you know, there would ultimately be a vote on it, and they could make him a citizen by act of Congress.
Now, you know, the law is pretty clear on the subject of legal residents in the U.S. who are not yet citizens. When they commit a crime, a serious crime, they are subject to deportation. Why should Mr. Perez get any kind of special treatment?
Well, you know, I think the issue, things aren't in a vacuum. Laws aren't in a vacuum. There are contexts to laws, you know. So not to equate it, but you could say, you know, Rosa Parks, you know, well, she broke the law, you know, she went to jail. But was that really the wrong thing to do? So with him, with Miguel, you know, he served two tours of duty in a very active area of Afghanistan with special forces. Most of the stuff he did is top secret. So, and it was at the beginning of the war, and I kind of did the numbers. There's only 0.004% of the U.S. population that actually serves in active duty. And then if you actually show the active duty members who are in a war zone, you know, you're talking about even less than that. So I do think, you know, there has to be a mechanism, or there is a mechanism in the sense of prosecutorial discretion on the part of ICE, and even, you know, at the level of the president and head of Homeland Security, they've always had the power to say, hey, we're going to pick and choose certain cases that we're going to focus on, and other ones we're not going to bother people. In this case, there hasn't been one person that we've come across in the government that's used common sense, that's had any empathy, or, you know, factored in this military service as, you know, and the other part of it is, but for his military service, which caused, brought him back extremely damaged from the war with severe PTSD and traumatic brain injury, he wouldn't have committed the crime. So, you know, you can't disconnect the military service from the criminal factor.
Now, ICE has said, though, that Mr. Perez, in the initial conviction, was caught with a significant amount of drugs that he handed over to a, I believe he was a someone undercover. I think the implication is that they consider his crime fairly significant or serious.
Yeah, well, you know, they, you know, in immigration law, you don't go by what you're charged with, and they never have and never, I don't think, will. But so a lot of that's hyperbole. So they're saying he was charged with, like, a large amount. I think they say 2 pounds. All I know is in immigration court, what matters is what you're convicted of. What he was convicted of was more than 15 grams and less than 90 grams. So it's about 0.02 pounds to 0.2 pounds is what he was convicted of. So they do like to throw out this big number to scare everybody. But it was his first offense, and he got a large sentence because I think they pled him out too easily. So he served, you know, he got a 15-year sentence, and he served 7.5 years in prison and was a model prisoner, got his associate's degree, 2-year college degree, which is as far as he could go while in prison, and tutored other inmates to get their GEDs. He finally got actually the proper kind of drug cocktail to treat his PTSD while in prison, which is kind of, I think, calls into question some of the VA's services, because when he was without but not in prison, the VA really couldn't help him very, very much. So that's kind of a sad statement.
Yeah. We're going to bring in Charles Roth here now. He's director of litigation at the National Immigrant Justice Center, located here in Chicago. His organization takes on legal fights involving immigrant issues and advocates for policy reforms. Mr. Roth, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. What kind of reforms do we need here, if any, when it comes to veterans and the immigration system?
Well, the thing I mean, to start at the beginning, I mean, what Congress has tried to do is to get the immigration authorities to work hand in glove with the military authorities so that when somebody is fighting on our behalf in places like Afghanistan, that there are laws in place that allow people to naturalize in an expeditious way when they're serving in the military. The problem has been historically that you need to get fingerprinted in order to get naturalized, and while he's off, in some field in Afghanistan and hiding on some mountain somewhere, that he's not able to make his way over to the INS fingerprinting office and so therefore the naturalization wouldn't proceed forward until he could somehow get done. I mean, it just didn't make any sense. Why would someone's service in Afghanistan be a good reason to delay their naturalization? And so nowadays Congress has passed some laws and they've mandated that the military and the immigration authorities work together. That was not in place at the time this gentleman served.
So there's a gap here that some soldiers have gotten caught up in.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate because the law doesn't. I mean, the law ought to have some additional give. I mean, it's not just a question of have you broken the law, you get deported. In general, immigration law tries to balance a person's sort of, if there are any bad acts, with the good acts and the reasons why we might not want to deport this person. When you have a more significant offense that gets labeled an aggravated felony, the law becomes very hard, though. And so you have these situations where even where you have really strong reasons not to deport the person, the fact that they have this aggravated felony ends up standing against them. It's not only aggravated felonies. I don't want to imply that's the only problem, but in general, that's the thing that we bump up against.
And does ICE have prosecutorial discretion here?
Well, they do, and a few years ago they might have been expected to sort of exercise that discretion more favorably. It seems like under the current regime there's a very marked reluctance to exercise the discretion that they have. Especially if there's any kind of criminal situation.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Bergen, back to you real quickly. Why did Miguel Perez not become a citizen when he had the chance, when he was in the military and he was entitled to expedited citizenship?
Yeah, well, he was, what happens quite often, our recruiters are under heavy pressure to get as many people in, especially, as we're approaching war-type status, and he was under the impression, and he said they told him he would become a citizen when he joined the military because you swear an oath to uphold the Constitution, protect the United States, and all that. But so he just assumed he was, and nobody from basic training to parachute school to light mechanics training, which he did, at no point in any of those placements in different forts around the United States, did any officer or commander or anybody have any, they never brought it to his attention and said, hey, we can get you your citizenship. You're not a citizen yet. Let's do it. And they can expedite it. It goes very quickly for military veterans. And it shouldn't be that his ability to become a citizen or not hinged on an arbitrary thing like he just happened to get the bad luck of the draw to have bad, commanders
bad information.
Who didn't understand the system, whereas there's all these other guys who are in the green card veterans or, are supporting them who became citizens who are in the exact same position as him, except when they went to basic training, their officers knew what they were doing, and they got him citizenship immediately.
All right,
so
Mr. Bergen,
really,
I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're running out of time. We could spend a lot more time on this topic. Thank you both for joining us. We should point out that we invited the Department of Immigration and Customs Enforcement to come on our show. They declined, but released a statement which reads in part that ICE respects the service and sacrifice of those in the military service and is deliberate in its review of those cases. You're listening to The 21st. for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nova Safo in for Nyla Boodoo. Every year, pre-K through third grade teachers in Illinois are nominated for the Golden Apple Award for Excellence in Teaching and Leadership. It's one of the most prestigious awards in teaching and one of the ones with the longest names. This year, there were a record 650 nominations. 10 of those teachers were surprised in their classrooms earlier this month with the award. Here's a sampling.
Well, like, this is just crazy.
Okay, that's just so cute. I can't even stand it. We're joined now by a handful of these Golden Apple winners. Carrie Garrett, a general education inclusion teacher at Lynn Thigpen Elementary School in Joliet. That's a Chicago suburb. And that was her classroom you just heard. Also, Heather Duncan is joining us. She teaches pre-K at South Shore Fine Arts Academy in Chicago. Carrie and Heather, welcome to the 21st.
Hello, thank you.
Good morning. And last but not least, sitting next to me in the studio is Chrissy Mitchell, a kindergarten teacher at Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Literary Fine Arts School in Evanston. Chrissy, thanks for coming in.
Sure, thanks.
It's good to have you here in the studio. I'm going to begin with you, since you're right here. You're my first victim. What's it feel like to win this award?
It's just crazy. I don't know. It's been kind of a whirlwind of the last couple days. It's amazing. It just, you put so much of your life into teaching, and to kind of get this feedback and this warm welcoming is so, it just feels so great.
So the part of the Golden Apple, what it does is they actually go in and surprise the teachers at their schools and the awards. We just heard a little bit of that. At your school, they held a school-wide assembly, and tell me about the moment when you got the surprise.
It was great. I actually, one of my coworkers and friends was trying to distract me leading up to it, and I was concerned I was in trouble because she told me our superintendent was there and looking for this document, and I was fidgeting, looking on my computer, and so I was walking into this assembly late, and as soon as they opened the doors, I saw all of the signs, and the kids yelled surprise, and I just kind of stood there. I wasn't sure what to do or where I was supposed to go, but it was fun.
All right. And Carrie, we heard a little clip of your surprise video at the beginning of our show. What was that moment like for you when you realized you had won?
I think it was completely, like, I was 100% stunned. I think I used the word crazy probably about a dozen times. but I was very overwhelmed, very, like, just shocked. And it wasn't until everything kind of, people kind of left and everything kind of subsided that the emotions and everything else really hit. It was very overwhelming.
And Heather, when you were being interviewed in a video about this interesting moment in your life, someone asked if they could nominate you for the Golden Globe earlier. They had asked you that. You have been teaching since 1994, and all these years later, how does it feel to actually win one?
It's actually surreal. It's not something that at the time, because I was a new teacher when the person said that to me, it was just a far off dream, you know? So it actually happening all these years later, it's really strange. As one of the ladies said, it's been a whirlwind since then, but the moment that they come into your room or come into your school, that's when the whirlwind starts. So it's so insane, like the energy that the people who come in bring, the energy that your kids and the staff in your school have. It's almost impossible to explain.
So I
heard, it was an amazing feeling.
Yeah, and I heard one of you was in your pajamas. Who was that?
That was me.
Can you explain?
So it was, we have a PBIS program to encourage positive behaviors in schools, and kind of the culmination of our work throughout the month of March was a school-wide pajama day. Mm-hmm. And so,
perfect timing.
Yeah, when my principal called my husband to tell him what was happening, he's like, you know it's pajama day. He's like, can you just make sure it's not too grungy?
Now, we're joking, but Chrissy, how meaningful is this award? What does it mean?
It means everything. It sounds so cheesy, but it just, that affirmation from the people around you and the reaching out that I've been getting from people that I haven't spoken with for years, it just, it's so humbling. It feels so wonderful to hear all of these words and to reconnect with people that I haven't seen for a while.
And Carrie, I'm told that you've been teaching for 16 years, but left the classroom and then came back. How did you find your way back?
I don't know. It was just I left to actually go do some reading specialist and work with small groups of kids and everything. And I also took a year off with one of my children. But I missed the connections that you have with the kids and the relationships that you build. And though you have that when you're a reading specialist, it's not quite the same as what you have when you're in the classroom. And I just wanted to get back to that. And when I did, I went back to a different grade, and it just felt like home. Like, you know, it sounds really weird to say, but it was like I never thought that first grade would be the place that I needed to be. But once I became this first grade teacher and I was back with my kids, I just was so happy to have those relationships and those connections that I had been missing for the couple of years that I was out of the classroom. So,
and so considering that you went, came back, it's been 16 years, what is the meaning of this award for you?
It's so overwhelming on so many different levels. And once again, just like what the other young lady said, it's like kind of like a validation that everything that you've been working so hard. I think teaching is definitely one of those career paths where it's not just like a career, but it's like a passion that you have, and you put everything into what you do on a daily basis. And so like in that regard, it's kind of like also very like reassuring that what you're doing is working. But on the other hand, I also think about my students and about my own children in particular, and I think about like the lesson that they have just learned from just a small moment in time, you know, having been witness to something, a person who's worked so hard, you know, can strive to great things. So.
And Heather, I'm told that right now you are working on a PhD in organizational leadership. This award, while meaningful, also comes with opportunity for even more study. How do you see this all contributing into what you do in the classroom?
Okay. So it contributes in a lot of different ways.
Huh?
Yeah, it's huge. Alrighty. The thing is for me, because I've been teaching such a long time, I did some calculations and realized that this is my 21st year, 2018. So, and that's just like in a public school classroom. At this point, I need to be really taking a look at what I'm doing in the context of sharing it with colleagues, particularly younger colleagues. This year I started, finally, formally mentoring new teachers. And so I need to be taking a really good hard look at what I'm doing in the classroom so that I can see what has worked for me and give advice out, because I had so many informal mentors. I had a wonderful, wonderful teacher who I worked with when I was actually getting my certification, University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Brenda Simpson, who is just a wonderful lady, works still in the same classroom that we worked in the First United Methodist Child Care Center. And she wasn't trying to mentor me, but she just was the best role model I could get. And then when I came to the Chicago area and started teaching in public schools, I had a wonderful principal, Telia Chilton, who had been a kindergarten teacher for a lot of her career. And so she really understood early childhood, and she mentored me a lot. And there are just so many other ladies, teachers from the Boucher School in Chicago, who just gave me all of their expertise with nothing expected in return.
Mm-hmm.
They just helped me because I was a young teacher who needed that. And it's really time for me to give that back to young teachers who need that. So
all
I
right.
have to be paying attention to what I'm doing. I learned as a National Board certified teacher that there are ways to inspect your practice so that then you can share what it is that you're doing that's working so that other people can gain from it.
And Chrissy, if very broadly speaking, what does make you a golden apple teacher? What is it that you could give to other teachers that you've learned in a very broad sense?
In a broad sense, I think it's all about the relationships. And that's something like when I have student teachers or people visiting in the classroom that I try to really relay to them is that building those relationships and taking the time to getting to know your students and their families is what's going to help build those connections and reach them the best way that you can. So just knowing that the slightest change in their schedule can throw them off for a day, and understanding that, I think, goes a long way into working together.
How about you guys? Carrie, why don't you take it?
I would definitely 100% say the same thing. It's all about relationships, fostering those relationships with family, with your students, and with students in the building and the community, because that's, you know, that's what you need to do to make these students successful and to want to continue to learn and to love being in school. And understanding that can make the difference between a good day or a bad day for a child. So I would agree.
All right. And Heather, pressure's on you to give a different answer. What do you got?
Well, I fully agree with these two ladies. But one of the really important things that I like to work on in my classroom is not just my relationships with the kids and families, but the relationships that the kids have among each other. Social-emotional learning is huge in my room, and it's huge in early childhood in general because it's just kind of personal because the kids are so small. But over the last couple of years, I've really been trying to be intentional about helping kids understand their emotions and how to be positive, cooperative, contributing members of a community, and then helping them to learn how they can take that out of the classroom, into their homes, into the rest of the school. Because my kids are so little, we don't do too much into the real community at large, just kind of a touching our toes in it. But the building of collaborative relationships and collaborative people is really important also. Mm.
You guys have a big platform right now. And Chrissy, I'll throw it to you first. What would you want parents to know about helping their kids succeed in school?
That's a hard one. I think since we teach such young children, one of the things that I harp on the most is to let kids be kids. I think school is so intense these days, and standardized testing is huge, and the expectations, even in my kindergarten classroom, they leave me as readers, which is amazing. I think I was mastering matching my upper and lowercase letters when I left kindergarten. But they need to be kids, and I am resistant to homework because I want them to play when they're at home.
Oh, you're my favorite teacher already.
when I finally moved my family to the suburbs, I remember watching my little girls play in the dirt, and I was like, yes, this is what being a kid is, just being dirty and having fun, and I want my parents to give that to their kids.
Heather and Carrie, how about it? What would you tell parents the most important thing to help kids succeed?
I think I would always say connection is the key. Like, always make sure, no matter how busy you are, that you give yourself and your children a few minutes every day to connect, talk about your day, put down the phone, turn off the TV, and just communicate and have that relationship with each other. You learn so much from just those few moments, and if you give your kids the opportunity to communicate, that is something that has no boundaries. So definitely connection.
Maybe also turn off the iPad, right?
Yes. Nobody wants to hear that. I don't want to turn off my phone. I know, but it's like so important to have that connection with your kids. I mean, I have a 12-year-old, and the things that he comes home and tells me now, because I've tried and worked very, very hard to foster that, I feel a little bit more comfortable with our relationship, and hopefully then he can continue that communication as he ventures into the world. But yeah, I just turn off the iPad.
All right. That's some great advice, guys. And we're going to leave it at that. Heather Duncan, Carrie Garrett, Chrissy Mitchell, all Golden Apple award-winning teachers. Thank you all for coming in and for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having us.
All right. You can always find past shows of The 21st on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montecelio. Fatima Farhaus, our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. I'm Nova Safo in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.